Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in the American West, part of the New Books Network. I'm Stephen Hausman, your host and visiting instructor at the University of Pittsburgh. Today, I'll be speaking with Joe Jackson. Joe previously held the Mina Hohenberg Darden Endowed Professorship in Creative Writing at Old Dominion University and has a long career as a journalist and nonfiction writer. His previous works include Dead Run, The Shocking Story of Dennis Stockton and Life on Death Row in America, and Atlantic Fever, Lindbergh, His Competitors, and The Race Across the Atlantic. We'll be talking about his most recent book, Black Elk, The Life of an American Visionary, which came out with Farrar, Straus, and Giroux in 2016, and in 2017 won the Francis Parkman Prize from the Society of American Historians. Thank you for coming on the podcast, Joe.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
To begin, why don't you first just tell us about yourself? What path did you take to writing professionally, and why did you get into investigative and historical nonfiction specifically?
Well, I don't know if I was traditional or not. I kind of bumped around, I think. I always liked reading. And I always liked writing. I was on the student newspaper in high school. And when I was in college at Florida State, I was both a psychology and an English major. And while there, and a little bit after graduation, I was a suicide counselor. And so I was always very interested in what makes people tick. But I also liked writing. So I got an MFA in creative writing at Arkansas, where I studied under one of the original Beats, a guy by the name of John Cullen Holmes, who was kind of the biographer of his buddies, Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg and those guys. And after I got out, I wanted to work in newspapers and magazines, and I ended up in a magazine for a little while, and then that went under, and then I started with a newspaper over here in Norfolk, Virginia, for about a dozen years. I was a beat reporter, cops and courts, and then I became an investigative reporter, and then I became a death row reporter. And after I spent time on a case where a fellow that we were pretty sure was innocent was executed, and he asked me to be a witness at his execution, I decided I was going to write a book about it. That was my first book. And then after that, I kept writing books. So.
And what brought you to the story of Black Elk in particular? How did you get interested in the Northern Plains and in the man himself?
Well, I think one thing you take away from being a beat reporter is that, you know, you're always, as a writer, you're always looking for the next story. And I think you start to, to get a feel instinctively for unfinished business in your last story, because that will lead to your next story. And so I had written a book also for our Straus and Giroux about the air race that made Charles Lindbergh famous, and how I got started doing that was that it was the Olympic years. I started thinking, why are we such a competitive society? I didn't really want to write about the winner. I wanted to write about the losers. And I wrote about the air race that made Lindbergh famous. But what that book ended up really being about was the way that American society creates and then destroys its secular saints and heroes. And then I was thinking, well, what does it take for society to consider somebody a true saint or a true holy person, a true holy man? And I first thought about writing a biography of Thomas Merton, but I was looking and somebody had written a pretty well-received biography of Merton, so that was out. And so I was looking around, and I remembered that when I was in school, one of my favorite books was Black Elk Speaks. And at the end of the 20th century, a bunch of theologians had been asked, who are the most influential American holy men of the 20th century? And several had said that they considered Black Elk the only really true bona fide holy man that that the United States had produced in the 20th century. So I started looking, and I already knew about Black Elk Speaks. So I started looking, and there was a lot of stuff on him. He had 30 days worth of interviews. He had a huge ream of oral interviews with the guy he co-wrote Black Elk Speaks with, John Neihardt, which offered a window into his mind. I mean, it was fascinating psychologically, and so that was what led me to Black Elk. The fact that I was able to peek into his mind so closely, and that society considered him a holy man. I just found that fascinating.
So this book is a biography, and I think that it makes sense to start at the beginning of Black Elk's life and just kind of go from there. So can you first tell us a bit about the context of his early years, of his childhood? Who are the Lakota as a people, and what was the social and political setting of the Northern Plains in the mid-19th century when he was born?
Well, he was born in 1863, and he was born in the Powder River country, which for the Lakota, I mean, we usually call them the Northern Sioux, which for the Lakota were the was kind of like the promised land for the Israelites. They had been looking for great hunting grounds in an area that was kind of away from the steady encroachment of white society. And when Black Elk was born in 1863, the Powder River country was still pretty pristine. I mean, the white society hadn't really mowed through it yet like it had through the Southern Plains. And but there were rumblings of kind of distant thunder. In 1862, the year before Black Elk was born, the Bozeman Trail was established. Well, actually, gold was discovered in Montana, and then so that was always like the death knell for natives, because, I mean, if there was going to be gold, then there were going to be white settlers. And then in 1864, the year after Black Elk was born, the Bozeman Trail was established, which was basically the path from the south for gold prospectors. And then, you know, settlers came and army forts came, and at that point you began to have the classic conflicts between the army and the Indians. So he was born right at the end of last free years of the Northern Plains Sioux. He was also born into a family where his father was a powerful medicine man, and his second cousin was not Sitting Bull, Crazy Horse, who was in many ways the Lakota thought of him, and he thought of himself as a holy warrior.
So what was Black Elk's childhood like then? How did everything you just described, how did it shape his earliest years?
Well, I mean, he was born into conflict. I mean, his even though he himself didn't see a lot of conflict until age 12 when he was in the Battle of the Little Bighorn. His father was, and his father had participated when he was still very young. His father participated. This was in December of 1866. His father participated in what was known as the Fetterman Massacre. This was outside of Sheridan, Wyoming, and at one of the forts along the Bozeman Trail, and the Sioux and the Cheyenne pretty much wiped out. The natives call it the Battle of the Hundred Slain, but it was about they killed somewhere between 80 and 90 U.S. cavalrymen, and during the battle, Black Elk's father was severely wounded in his leg. We don't ever really know what happened, but he would be lame for the rest of his life. And you know, every native male, I mean, part of his responsibilities was to feed his family. So that was severely cut into. So Black Elk would feel that from his childhood. Luckily, you know, his father was also a respected medicine man, which means that he was a counselor to the tribe, and he was also, you know, it's also like a job. So and all during his preteen years, there was talk of conflict. I mean, the first years of his life took place during what was called Red Cloud's War. The only war, Red Cloud was a Lakota chief, and Red Cloud's War was the only native conflict in which the natives won, and the Sioux, the Northern Sioux, were kind of helped single them out for repercussions down the line by the U.S. Army, but at the same time, it established them as a force to be feared. So I mean, he was, you know, he was born into kind of a high status family, but it was a good world for them, but it was a world which all of them feared was going to end, and they could see the buffalo herds diminishing. So it was like, for the first 15 years of Black Elk's life, there was always this pressure that they could be wiped out. That was the talk he always heard around him.
And it's within this period of his life that he experiences the great vision, which would alter and shape the course of much of the rest of his life. So can you describe in some detail that vision and how he and those around him interpreted it?
Well, he was nine, and he fell into a coma for about 11 days. And, of course, it's always hard to interpret what, it's always hard to diagnose historically what somebody's disease is, but it seems to have been, as best as I can tell, and other people have said, it seems to have been a bout of childhood meningitis, and he And he lay close to death for 11 days. And during those 11 days, he had a vision where he was swept out of the teepee where he was battling for his life. And he was taken into the clouds to the great cloud teepee of the spirits, the elders, and you know, each one had a different power, but basically what you get is a Joseph Campbell type of image where he where a people is threatened, where the hero is sent out on a quest. He accrues powers and magical tools, and he comes back, and it's his responsibility to save or redeem his people. And he, you know, he survived that. He survived the bout of meningitis, and he remembered his vision with crystal clarity. In fact, much of the rest of his life would be spent either trying to repeat his role as savior for his people, as he saw in his vision, or when he no longer thought that was possible, at least preserve his vision for later generations. So this vision that he had when he was 9 would basically become would cast the rest of his life. He would spend the rest of his life in some way trying to deal with this. And since he never really, I mean, he became a fairly powerful medicine man as time went on, but since he, since his people, you know, continued to die off from diseases and reservation life and starvation and this, that, and the other, he, for the longest time, felt that it was his fault because he somehow didn't understand his vision completely.
And it's about at the same time, or close to the same time, that Black Elk experiences this vision that Americans begin to invade the Black Hills and the area around the Black Hills. And that also brings us to the Battle of Little Bighorn, which you describe in some detail in the book, and partially from the perspective of Black Elk himself. So can you tell us a bit about this lead up to the battle and the battle itself and its place in Black Elk's personal and spiritual life?
Well, they lived where Black Elk's band of Northern Lakota lived was always close to the Black Hills, and the Black Hills were Sitting Bull described the Black Hills as, you know, basically their backpack, their grocery store. I mean, not only was it the a holy place for them, but it was also a place where, in time of deprivation, they could go and they could, you know, they could get food and they could get teepee poles and they could get shelter and they could get, you know, everything they pretty much needed. So it was an important place for them, both spiritually and physically. And just a couple of years before the Battle of the Little Bighorn, which was in 1876, the United States had violated its treaty with the Sioux, and it had opened up the Black Hills. This was like the summer of 1874, and this outraged the Sioux. I mean, they had you know, settled a treaty with the American government after Red Cloud won the Red Clouds War. A big part of that was that there was this huge Sioux reservation where they would be left, where the Sioux would be left alone, but then gold was discovered in the Black Hills during an expedition led by Custer, and of course what that meant was that whites started taking over the Black Hills, and that outraged everybody. That outraged all of the Lakota, and probably the center of that outrage was was Sitting Bull, who was we all know who Sitting Bull was, but he was also a member of one of the northern, even far northern tribes of the Lakota, farther north than Black Elk's tribe. Sitting Bull was Hunk Papa, and Sitting Bull was, you know, a natural leader, and he had visions about driving the whites out of the Black Hills, and we have to fight, because if the whites take the Black Hills, then they're eventually going to exterminate us. And so between 1874 and 1876, there was just growing consolidation among the tribes, and there was this growing outrage, and finally the U.S. Army said, which was always trying to get the Indians back on the reservations, said, "You all have to be on your reservations." And the outraged Lakota said, "You know, no, we're not." And they headed west into the Powder River, and that was when the fatal expedition that included Custer started chasing after them.
And despite the Lakota victory at the Battle of Little Big Horn, the years after that battle quickly become a period of crisis for the Lakota and their allies on the Northern Plains. So how did this happen, and how did the various bands and families, including Black Elk's family, how did they respond to this and to the conquest of the Black Hills?
Well, they the army wore them down. I mean, they won, but you know, they beat Custer. They wiped out 200 something men of Custer's troop, and it happened during the unfortunately for the Lakota, it happened during the American Centennial, when, you know, the United States was celebrating how great and how powerful it was. And actually there was the there was the big American Centennial Fair that people were going to from all over, at least the East Coast. And then here comes this news that Custer had been wiped out. And it was a huge shock. I mean, I would say that it was as huge of a shock for the Americans at that time as Pearl Harbor was or 9/11 was. I mean, and if you look at our country's history, you often see that when there's some sort of military or some sort of related disaster like that, at first there's shock and then there's rage, and so the U.S. Army started to ruthlessly hunt down the Sioux, and they chased them east across the plains up into North Dakota, and then they just started to starve them out over time. So that by 1877 or 1878, and of course, remember, the army was also wiping out the buffalo at that time too. So basically, the Sioux were on the run, and they were being starved out. And the only place where they could get any food was on the reservations. And so slowly, through 1877 and 1878. The Lakota of the Northern Plains started surrendering and drifting back into the reservations, and that's what happened with Black Elk. And one of the last holdouts was Black Elk's second cousin, Crazy Horse, and there was a lot of controversy around, a lot of politics around Crazy Horse. Crazy Horse was one of the last of the of Black Elk's band to surrender. And in the summer of 1877, when he and his people surrendered, they surrendered down in close to Pine Ridge, where the Oglala, that's Black Elk's band, were there on the reservation today. There were a lot of rumors swirling around Crazy Horse, and people were the army and the United States government was still scared of him, thinking that he could be a kind of a bellwether for a rebellion. And in September of 1877, he was going to be arrested, and he fought back, and he was bayoneted, and he was killed. And he and Black Elk was in the crowd when this happened, and once again, that was a huge tragedy. And whereas before, the Lakota might have stayed on the reservation after Crazy Horse's assassination, that threw a real cog into the works, and a number of Lakota went north across what they called the Medicine Line, that was the border between Canada and the United States, and they tried one last time to live the old Free Plains Indian lifestyle up in Canada, but once again there weren't enough buffalo, and they were starved out. By the late 1870s, early 1880s, everybody went back to the reservation.
Tell us a little bit about Black Elk and his family's life on the reservation. How did they adjust to all the litany of changes that you just described? And more specifically, how did Black Elk himself, how was he handling the burden of having very regular spiritual experiences throughout this period of his life?
Well, it scared him. By the 1880s, he was 17, 18. And by this point, he had always believed that, he had powers and that his powers were growing. He seemed to have second sight. He seemed to know things before they were going to, happen, especially when it came to, hunting with his father or with relatives. But around the time when he was 17 or 18, he started to hear voices, and he thought the voices were threatening. He thought the voices were being told or telling him, you've got to do something with your vision. You've got to act on your vision, or it's not going to go well for you. And so he fell into a kind of frenzy, which is really interesting. I mean, when you're writing a book like this too, you've got to remember that that even though you have to as the author, I'm always mindful of being respectful of Lakota tradition. I'm also very aware that my audience comes from a Western scientific tradition where if somebody's hearing voices, they're crazy. Well, in the Native tradition, that's not necessarily so. If you're hearing voices, they mean something, and they're a visitation from another dimension, from the spirits. And so Black Elk was scared to death that he was not fulfilling his promise and he was going to be exterminated. And so by the early 1880s, he was visiting medicine men within his tribe and begging for help. And he told them about the vision really for the first time. And that's kind of interesting because the medicine men in his tribe, I mean, if you look at it, the medicine men in his tribe are really acting in a spiritual way. They're acting very much like psychologists or psychiatrists. This is what's the matter. This is what you've got to do. And at least within the Oglala tradition, if you have been chosen by the gods, then you have to act out your dreams. And so Black Elk started acting out his different portions of his vision. And since he acted them out, these were in elaborately staged dances, and almost cinematic in the way that the whole tribe would participate. His reputation as a holy man grew, and then he also very probably became, because he came from a, you know, his father was a medicine man, started to develop a reputation as a healer as well. In fact, part of his vision included some medical recipes, it seems. And so during the 1880s, which was the first full decade of the reservation period for the Lakota, they were cooped up on the reservation. They were forced to eat stringy beef, which didn't always arrive on time. They were subject to all of the white diseases. Whooping cough was killing off all these kids. He became a healer, and it was during the 1880s that his reputation as a healer, as a medicine man, grew. So basically, it went from early 1880s, where he feared for his life because he didn't know how to deal with these voices, to the late 1880s, where he grew in confidence and power as a healer.
What brought Black Elk into contact with Buffalo Bill Cody and his Wild West show? That's another pivotal moment in the young man's life. And so how did that happen, and what was his experience as a member of this traveling show?
Well, he joined up, I think it was, let me look at my timeline here. It was, he joined up with Buffalo Bill in fall of 1886. Cody had already started his Wild West show by then. By that point, he was only going through the U.S. He had this disastrous show down in New Orleans, I think it was, where, you know, all of his stock and was on a riverboat, and it capsized, and he lost everything. And at that point, the only Indian performers he had were the Pawnee. But Cody had, you know, Cody over the years, many of these guys who fought against the Indians, I mean, they came to know and respect the Indians over time. And over the years, I mean, he got to know several of the Sioux elders. And in fall of 1886, in the spring of 1886, he kind of let it be known at Pine Ridge Reservation that, I want to go across the country and have these Wild West shows where, you know, I've got the Indians charging in and fighting the army. And by then, Black Elk, who was always curious about all spiritual matters, was thinking several things. He was saying, well, the whites have beaten us, and they've put us on the reservations, and the source of their power might be their white god. Well, okay, maybe I can go to the source of the power, the cities, and see what is so good about the white god. And by that point, you know, various religious denominations had started to come into the reservations and have established churches and established schools in various reservations across the United States. And so Black Elk, by the mid 1880s, had some exposure to, by that point, it would have been the Episcopalians and also the Catholics, so the Catholics weren't officially ensconced in the Pine Ridge Reservation. So he was interesting. He was interested. He was always very curious about all sorts of religions, and he was also a young man, and this was a chance to go across the country with his buddies. All of his buddies were going across the country, so he took off with, you know, this big contingent of young Sioux guys, and they first went to Chicago, I think it was, and then they went to New York, and then while they were they went to Madison Square Gardens, and they were a huge hit, and Black Elk was amazed by everything he saw, and while this would have been like 1887, and in spring of 1887, Cody got a contract to take his Wild West show to the over to London to the Golden Jubilee of Queen Victoria. She'd been on the throne for 50 years, and performers from across the world were coming to perform. And so, you know, this was a big coup for Cody. So he loaded everything on a steamer, including his buffalo and elk and horses, and they took off on a 10 to 14 day cruise across the, it wasn't really a cruise, it was pretty horrendous, across the Atlantic, and Black Elk performed in London and throughout England through 1887, 1888 with Cody's Wild West. He also danced before the Queen. That's one of the high points of Black Elk speeds.
Which brings us to 1890, which was, of course, another crucial and tragic year for the Lakotas, since in that December, the U.S. Army massacred over 200 men, women, and children at Wounded Knee. What was Black Elk's relationship to the ghost dance religion, which was one of the precipitating events or movements that led to that massacre? And then how did the massacre itself affect him and his family?
Well, he had come back and he and Black Elk and three of his friends had accidentally missed the boat when Cody came back to the United States, and there were other Wild West shows, competing Wild West shows in Europe and in England by that time. So they joined up with some, Black Elk and his friends joined up with this group called the Mexican Joe Wild West, and it was pretty awful. People were trying to kill each other, and they were crashing stage coaches, and he got progressively sicker. And when Cody, and he also fell in love with a Parisian girl, and he was in Paris in May of 1889 when Cody presents his Wild West show in Paris for the first time, and he was there for the exposition, which pretty much introduced the Eiffel Tower, and Black Elk shows up and says, "Remember me," and everybody gives him a big party. And Cody says, "Do you want to stay with me or do you want to go back home?" And Black Elk says, "I'm homesick. I want to go back home. And I've also been a little bit sick." And so Cody buys him a ticket and sends him right back home. And he shows up in Pine Ridge around the time that this messianic movement, the ghost dance religion, is sweeping through plains tribes across the West, pretty much from down around the Paiutes, down in Utah and Nevada, and then to the northeast through the Upper Plains. And there are a lot of tribes that adopted the ghost dance, and it was basically it was basically the same sort of messianic movements that has you see in Christianity since time immemorial. If you believe in the message of the Messiah, if you do certain things, in this case, dance the ghost dance, then at a certain time, your enemies will be swept off the face of the earth, or will disappear, leaving only, the chosen ones, in this case, the Plains Indians, and their life will return to a golden age. And the Sioux embraced it to a large extent, especially the Oglala, which was Black Elk specific tribe, and he resisted it. He resisted it for a while because, I mean, he was always very critical about religions. I mean, he was at the same time that he was a spiritual seeker. I mean, he was in his own way, he was kind of a religious scholar, but he kept seeing all of these convergences between his great vision and the ghost dance religion, and so he finally became a ghost dance priest, and the U.S. Army. So this would have been like 1889, 1890, and the U.S. Army was always still scared of the Sioux, and so when they saw them beginning to embrace the ghost dance religion, they felt, uh-oh, we're going to have, the Sioux are going to be rejuvenated, they're going to, we're going to have another fight on our hands, and what happened was that the army was called out and eventually led to the massacre of Wounded Knee.
And as you say in the book, we don't know a whole lot about Black Elk's life in the years immediately after the massacre. So tell us what we do know, and then when his memoir picks back up again in the early 20th century, what is his life like, and what struggles is he facing at that period?
Well, his memoir, Black Elk Speaks, at least ends in with his participation in the Wounded Knee massacre. He wasn't there when it started, but he was there with a bunch of his friends trying to save women and children who were running away from the soldiers who were slaughtering them in a frenzy afterwards. He watched the aftermath of that. One of the more powerful passages in Black Elk Speaks, and also in his oral interviews, is just him coming down to the killing fields and seeing all these dead women and children, and having survivor's guilt and saying, "Why am I still alive?" And Wounded Knee was like December 1890, and you don't really hear a lot about Black Elk in 1891. In fact, you don't a lot of various Lakota that you're aware of, they kind of drop off the face of the map during this period, except for the ones who were high up in the ghost dance, and they get sent off to prison. And then a bunch of them eventually go on and perform with Buffalo Bill again. But Black Elk kind of disappears, and you kind of get the idea that he went underground because he didn't want to be sent off to prison with a lot of the other ghost dance priests. But by 1890, I'd say about 1891, 1892, you start to hear in the records, you start to hear little bits and pieces about Black Elk. I mean, there's a memoir by a cattleman who lives in the Nebraska, right south of the Pine Ridge Reservation. And he would talk about how these famous old Indians would come to his spread every year, and they'd have a feast, and he'd let them hunt, and it was kind of like reliving the old days. And Red Cloud would come, and Spotted Tail would come, and in one passage he says, you know, and Black Elk would come, who was by who I understand was one of their two most powerful medicine men. So through the 1890s until about 1904, you begin to get bits and pieces of how Black Elk is a powerful healer. But in one way that you hear about this is through the Catholics, because by now the Catholic priests had they had their missions and they had their schools in Pine Ridge. And what you basically had were two sets of competing priests. There were the old Lakota medicine men, and there were the black robes, the Jesuit priests, and they were fighting for people's souls. And so you hear about Black Elk through these diaries and things of the Jesuit priests. He was a competitor, and Black Elk seems to have been a fairly active competitor until about 1904. And around in the early 1900s, Black Elk was married twice, and his first wife, he had three children, three sons by his first wife. Two of them died. His father died. His wife died. Death was taking place all around him. His religion was not saving people. His vision was not saving people. He felt like a failure. And in 1904, he had what appears to have been the second of his confrontations with a Jesuit priest, and whereas in the first one he held his own, in the second one he was just felt morally defeated, and he also had a bleeding ulcer which was giving him lots of pain, and he basically converted to Catholicism. So from 1890 until 1904 he was a force. Then in 1904 he converted.
Do you have a sense of what Black Elk's relationship was like to Catholicism after his conversion?
I think he was a man on fire for the first 10 years of that. I mean, up until about 1916, he supposedly converted 400 Indians across the plains, and maybe even up in Canada. He became friends with a young Catholic priest who called him an Indian St. Paul, and he pretty much went across the West converting native souls to Catholicism. I think that although he never really, there was always an underground of other of traditional holy men, he never seemed to turn them in, to betray them. But at least during this period, 1904 to 1916, I mean, he bought into the being a Catholic lay minister, heart and soul. I mean, he cut his hair. He started wearing suits. He would appear at the bedside of dying Lakota with a priest or without a priest, because there were always very few priests out there in the plains to give extreme unction to dying Lakota, and you know, he was so effective that at least in the latter part of the 20th century, anybody who knew Black Elk didn't really remember him as a traditional holy man. They remembered him more as a Catholic lay priest. But then by 1916, something seemed to happen again, and he started to see that, well, you know, the Catholicism wasn't saving his people. They were still dying. And so he started at, as of 1916, the evidence seems to show that he became more ecumenical. He was still Catholic, but he was also, he returned to the old ways. And he started training the next generation of Lakota holy men, including his nephew, who wrote about him, fellow by the name of Frank Fools Crow, who wrote about Black Elk during that period. So I mean, he was switching religiously, spiritually during all of this time.
And when Black Elk is in his, I think his early 70s, he meets a poet, a Great Plains poet by the name of John Neihardt, who you alluded to earlier. And Neihardt had arrived at Black Elk's home to hear the old man's story. So tell us a bit about Neihardt and about what drew him to Black Elk, and then what came of their meeting.
Well, Black Elk met Neihardt in 1930. So Black Elk would have been 60 by about that time.
Oh, okay.
And a lot of his old friends were dying off, and Black Elk had been diagnosed with tuberculosis, and he thought to himself, you know, I'm not very long for this world. And the great unresolved question of my life is this great vision, and I've done what I could to adhere to the great vision, but I failed my people somehow. So it's my job to pass the great vision on to the next generation. And so Neihardt, so you got this, you know, these two guys cross paths. Neihardt was by 1930. Neihardt was a pretty well known figure on the plains. He wrote these long epic poems about the winning and then the disappearance of the West. He called them his songs, and he had like a song cycle. And he had just written he had just published a song cycle about the death of about Little Bighorn and then the death of Crazy Horse. And he wanted to do something about the ghost dance. That was going to pretty much be the end. And by now it had started to leak out. This was 50 years or so after, or more after the Little Bighorn. And historians all over the West were starting to realize that, you know, we talked to all of these old timers who, you know, may have survived the Little Bighorn, with Reno's command, but we never really talked to the Indians all that much. And so these historians started going out and getting these oral histories, and people started to figure out through detective work that Black Elk had been the second cousin of Crazy Horse, and they started coming to him. And he had turned down a couple of offers of interviews about Crazy Horse. He just didn't feel like, you know, he trusted the people, I don't guess. And Neihardt appears at Pine Ridge Reservation during the summer of 1930, and he says to the government agent in charge, are there any old ghost dance priests around? And the agent says, well, my Lakota friends here tell me that there's this old man who lives up north of Wounded Knee, who had been a kind of a priest, and so Neihardt and his son, they've been on a reading out to the west. Neihardt and his son go up to Black Elk's house. Black Elk is just kind of standing out there, seemingly waiting for them. It's dusty out there. I'm sure Black Elk would have seen the dust plume coming from miles away and from Neihardt's car. And Blackout took to him. I mean, Neihardt had had some visions of his own during two near-death experiences that he had had, and he explained that, you know, he was a poet, and Blackout seemed to see in Neihardt a way of, if he told his story, that he would have a way of preserving his great vision. And so he pretty much said, yeah, you come back in a year and I'll have a teaching space set up for you. And but I'm only going to do it if you spend a considerable amount of time on my vision. And Neihardt agreed to that at the same time that he wanted to tell the story of the ghost dance. So a year later, Neihardt shows up with his two daughters, and Black Elk's son is there, who's going to act as a translator. His son, Ben, had been to the Indian school in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. And so he knew English. And for a month, Black Elk basically told his story from birth until wounded knee, and a little bit afterwards. But Neihardt he spent a long time on his great vision, and Neihardt came away from that, 3.5 week oral interview, really excited. He went to William Morris, and William Morrow, his publisher in New York, and said, "I've really got something here," and so he fashioned Black Elk Speaks out of that.
And Black Elk dies a couple decades later in 1950. Can you tell us a little bit about the final years of his life and more generally about his legacy and the legacy of Black Elk Speaks, the book that came out of his and Neihardt's meetings?
Well, Black Elk was, when he died in 1950, he'd been around since 1863. So what was he? He was 87 years old. I mean, he was an old man, especially by reservation standards, because so many people had died from disease and everything. And just think of the incredible changes that he had witnessed. I mean, he'd been around the world. He had been around the country. He, he was a literate man, so he was very aware of, jets and war and space age and all that kind of stuff. I mean, you know, the guy had witnessed incredible changes, but he had tuberculosis, and in his later years, he became more debilitated, as everybody does when they get older and sicker, he kind of sank within himself, and he would spend long periods of time on a hilltop, either repeating the Catholic Catechism or praying to the old Lakota gods, and he mixed them up a lot because to him they were really very much one and the same. And because they had so many convergences, the two types of spiritual traditions had so many convergences. And he would occasionally have these visions. And he, before he died, he told his daughter and his son, watching the skies, something interesting might happen. And the night that he died, the aurora borealis put on this huge show. I mean, greater than it ever had that far south before. And you might think, oh, that's just kind of like oral embellishment at the end of his story, but it was either Sky and Telescope or one of the other one of the other astronomical magazines at that time had these articles about how amazing the sky show was on that night, and how because the fireworks went on for so long, at such intensity that for the first time, land instruments were able to pick up, you know, readings about radiation and stuff like that that they'd never been able to do so before. So I mean, it really happened. And by that point, he was respected by the younger traditional medicine men in Pine Ridge. They pretty much, I mean, you know, the traditional ways were still severely frowned upon by both the Catholics and by the U.S. government. So it was all underground. But he was an example. He was a model for this younger generation. And as far as Black Elk Speaks went, Black Elk Speaks was published in 1931. And it was just a little bit too strange for the American reading public, and so it went into remainders really fast. But it had a following, and in the later 1930s, the famous dream psychologist Carl Jung was lecturing about dreams and psychology and legend and that kind of stuff over at Yale, and somebody brought him a copy of Black Elk Speaks, and he was really excited by it. He thought to himself, this is an example of the real thing. This is where, you know, the great religions come from. And you know, he believed that Jung would write that all of our religious traditions come from what he would call the universal unconscious, which we tapped into in dreams. And so he went back to Germany and Switzerland. He was Swiss, and he tried to get it published in German. But World War II intervened, and then after World War II, he was able to get it published by a German publisher. 1955, and then, as often happens, American scholars kind of, because of Jung, they rediscovered what they had in their own backyard, and by 1961, Black Elk Speaks was republished, and it was slowly embraced by the counterculture. But then, in 1968, by the later 1960s, you know, the counterculture and the green movement were in full swing, with the other book that was big at that time, Dee Brown's "Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee." It became, you know, one of the two Bibles of the resurgent Native spiritual movement, especially among people who wanted to be Native, mostly white hippies and later New Age people. And then in 1973, there was Wounded Knee 2, and it became even more famous after that. So, and it's been pretty famous ever since then.
So, as this interview has made pretty apparent, Black Elk lived a very long and a fascinating life, and he witnessed a number of critical events in American and Lakota history. And as such, this is a long and a fascinating book as well. But if you were to distill the book down and maybe hope that there was one takeaway that readers came away from the book with, what might that be, Joe?
And that's a good question. I've often wondered that myself. You're not the first person who's asked that. I mean, you know, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, I started out writing the book trying to answer the question of what is it that makes a holy man, and I'm not sure if anybody has ever has ever answered that question about, you know, any of the holy men that are or the spiritual leaders that are out there, what draws people to them. But I do think that what you see is that in the face of all the things that happen to an embattled people, that somebody like Black Elk just endures and kind of like stays the course and stays on the message and endures. And even though Black Elk had you know, multiple tragedies in his life, and you know, witnessed, you know, many people whom he loved die, and watched his, you know, tribe grow sicker and smaller. He never really seemed to give up, and he never really seemed to break away from the feeling that a personal creed or a personal holiness trumped all else, that it in the end was one of the most important things in life. And I think that if you look at other religions, you kind of see that a kind of quiet determination and endurance in the face of, you know, multiple obstacles.
So now that the book has been out for a couple of years, what have you been working on since then? Do you have another project coming down the line at all?
Well, I've got a manuscript deadline of May 2020. In this case, you know how I said that I kind of take unfinished business from the last book. So now I'm doing this long narrative of the Spanish American and Philippine American Wars of 1898 through 1902, and I'm following several people through it, and that was an important, it was an important war, because, you know, we went from being basically enclosed little United States to a colonial power, and what started out, you know, the 6 weeks of war is a splendid little war in Cuba turns into this long, horrendous slog in the Philippines, where people, many people's spirits were broken, and there was a lot of controversy. In many ways, it was very much like Vietnam. There was a lot of protest, and a lot of people came back with what today would be called PTSD, and there's a lot of going to lots of archives. I followed some people's footsteps across Cuba. I drove in a 1955 Ford Fairlane across Cuba. I followed Private Carl Sandburg's footsteps across Puerto Rico when he was a mere private, before he was even the poet Carl Sandburg. And I'm shooting for going to the Philippines in March to get the point of view of some of the rebels over there.
That sounds great. And those are events that I feel like not enough Americans know in any kind of depth. So
yeah,
good for
you
for choosing that.
And it's like Manifest Destiny all over again, except that in this case, instead of being just within the United States against the Indians, it's like, you know, across the world.
Well, great. We look forward to it.
Well, thank you. I have to write it still.
Joe Jackson is formerly the Mina Hohenberg Darden Endowed Professor of Creative Writing at Old Dominion University, and has had a long career as an investigative journalist and as a nonfiction writer. His most recent book, Black Elk, The Life of an American Visionary, came out with Farrar, Straus, and Giroux in 2016, and in 2017 won the Francis Parkman Prize from the Society of American Historians. Thanks again for coming on the podcast, Joe.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.